Okay, we're going to start. We asked three questions last week. We pointed out the feast days in Islam. I really didn't note them, per se. The one feast day that we are aware of, perhaps, is Ramadan, where they fast during the day and they eat at night. But they have a series of feast days. They're not necessarily part of the five pillars. So you have the feast days, and then we talked about the imprint on the rock under the Dome of the Rock. And I have a paragraph in there about the imprint of Muhammad's foot, or one, it says, the stone tried to follow Muhammad as he ascended, leaving his footprint here while pulling up and hollowing out the cave below. The impression of the hand of the Archangel Gabriel made as he restrained the stone from rising is nearby. So they have that kind of stuff going on. What do we think of that? Yeah. Right, you don't believe it. I'm with you. Okay, and then someone asked asked the question, have the Muslims killed more people than Hitler? I'm not sure. Anyways, I went to a website, because you can find anything on the internet, and I do have a paragraph concerning that. I'm not sure the veracity of the AmericanThinker.com, this particular article, but it's someone had took a lot of time compiling it. So you have those three things as a handout. See it? Now, in your notes, what I've done, we're doing the history of Christianity. Did I pray? No, I didn't pray. So let us pray, and then we'll continue. Our Father, we thank you for the opportunity we have as your people to gather in this place, the opportunity we have to just think thoughts without fear of persecution and gather. Father, we pray that as we look at the origin of Christianity, at least some of the snapshots, that it would encourage us to simply persevere in our love for you and your church. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. It will be impossible, again, it's one of these things when you talk about world religions, Buddhism, and I hope that there have been some takeaways. If we say Buddhism, we have the Four Noble Truths and then the Eightfold Path. If you think of Hinduism, polytheism and pantheism. If you think of Islam, you have the five pillars, eight articles of faith and the five pillars. And all of them are autosoteric, self-salvation. Christianity is a grace-based, at least it's supposed to be. Sometimes it gets muddied, but it's supposed to be a grace-based gospel, good news, where we're not saving ourselves, we're being saved from. What I've done with your notes, Christianity, when you talk about the history of Christianity, I've pointed this out with Judaism, in that Christianity is in a sense the heir of the Old Testament. There's one story, Jesus is at the center. Judaism is not a perpetuation of the Old Testament. The church or the New Testament is a perpetuation of the Old Testament. Whether you agree with me or disagree, do you understand what I'm saying? So if we talk story, I'll show you in a minute on the big screen, but if we talk story, we have Old Testament, Jews, and then it goes New Testament, Church. Judaism is a mutation. It's not continuing Old Testament. Not the Old Testament narrative. They obviously think they are, but they're not. They think they are, but they're not because I said they're not. But the front end of your notes, all the slides, are... look at page 68. All the slides are simply giving you a lot of this, the idea of one story. But if you look at page 68, and you look at the two slides at the top of page 68, I really like my slides. I put down Old Testament, New Testament. Old Testament, 39 books. New Testament, 27. Old Testament runs from Genesis to Malachi. New Testament, in our canon, runs from Matthew to Revelation. The Old Testament is shadow. New Testament is substance. The Old Testament is seed, promise, blood, picture. The New Testament is fulfillment, completion. You do have near, far. It's telling the biblical story. Old Testament is Israel. New Testament is church. Old Testament is physical promises. New Testament is physical fulfillment. And it all centers on Jesus the Christ. So now when you go to page 71, I'm wanting you to see this slide. And the quote, it's from the Jewish Encyclopedia, so it's not something... I found the article interesting, but it was so long I did not want to run it off. But it read, it began with this sentence: Christianity is the system of religious truth based upon the belief that Jesus of Nazareth was the expected Messiah. This author refutes the idea, or at least is saying Jews do not believe that to be true, was the expected Messiah or Christ, and that in him all the hopes and prophecies of Israel concerning the future have been fulfilled. So I thoroughly enjoyed putting together this study, but it's all in slide form, and I'm going to be giving you snapshots. So when we talk about church history and we're launching, I'm hopefully going to help you. We looked at what does Judaism believe, what does Hinduism believe, what does Buddhism believe, what does Islam believe. Well, I'm not going to tell you what Christians believe. If you don't know, you need to be in a different class. But I'm not going to tell you that. What I'm going to tell you is its development or history, the story. Okay, and I'm going to give you a snapshot because it'll be impossible to really bore down and bring certain things to light. It's just impossible. It's too much. But when you talk about church history, you have what are called the first century, which takes you to the book of Revelation, the Gospel of John, or the letters of John, 90 AD, the first century, the first 100 years, you have present in the New Testament letters. Are you with me so far? Okay. Then you have what are called the Nicene Fathers. They're the Ante-Nicene Fathers, which are the fathers preceding this 325 event, Constantine, and the politicizing of Christianity. Okay. Those are called the Nicene Fathers. They're the ones that happened in the 4th century or the 300s. And then after that period, you have what are called the Post-Nicene Fathers. So when I was in seminary, there was a series of books called the Ante-Nicene, Nicene, and Post-Nicene Fathers. This is what that series of books looked like. You have, is it colored in your book? Okay. The red are the Ante, the green are the middle, the Nicene, and then the blue are the Post-Nicene Fathers. This whole set of books are the letters or the writings or the homilies, the sermons of these people. So far, you're still with me? So you have first century church, and we have what that looks like when we read the New Testament epistles. And we I've said this before, but we think, well, the Corinthian church was really screwed up. Okay? Thank you. You know, newsflash. The Corinthian church is like the Waukesha church. But I don't necessarily look at the Corinthian church as screwed up. I see what they were as normal. And that's what church life looks like under the curse. And sometimes people say, well, you know, you guys got problems. I'm not going to go there. Well, if that's your standard, you'll go nowhere. In fact, yeah, the only way you know that Waukesha is a perfect church is if you don't get involved in leadership. But if you get involved in leadership, you realize that problems exist in any fellowship. So the first century church, and what's equally interesting is all the letters in the New Testament are called occasional letters. They're written because a problem exists, and the letter is a response or answer to the problem. So obviously, if we think that was the golden age of the church, we're just not thinking clearly. But after the first century church, you have the New Testament letters, which reflect what the church was like during that period. Then you have what are called the post-apostolic or the Ante-Nicene Fathers. I'll talk about them in just a moment. And I'm really just skimming the surface. I'm giving you a snapshot. You have the post-apostolic Ante-Nicene Fathers. These are people who are somehow directly connected to the first century church. I'll show you that in a moment. Then you have the fourth century, the Nicene Fathers, that's really with Constantine and the politicizing, which many would suggest was the downfall of the church. What the church was up until this point in time is not what the church becomes from this point forward. But there's neat things happening in the 4th and 5th century. When I say neat, it might not be really cool like the fall of Rome, but it really shapes how you think about what was going on, because history doesn't happen in a vacuum. And then you have the 5th century, the 400s, the post-Nicene fathers. Your handout will help you see this a little bit better, but I thought the slide itself was absolutely cool, and it wasn't something that I was going to be able to mock up, but take a look at it for just a moment. Notice the blue would be the apostles, and then the red are the post-apostolic or the anti-Nicene fathers. And if you look at the other sheet across the page, that might be a little bit clearer. I just thought the color was cool, okay? But it's a neat chart. But if you look at the one on page 73, it explains a little bit better what that chart, the color chart, is saying. Notice you have Jesus Christ, then you have Paul, Peter, John. I mean, you have these apostles, but it's highlighting three. Those are the apostles. And then you have post-apostolic, post-apostles, or the anti-Nicene, the ones preceding the Nicene period. And just note it. Note this. Because if I asked you, have you ever heard of Clement of Rome? I'm not going to quiz you if you do raise your hand. Okay, but you've heard of Clement of Rome. You've heard of Ignatius of Antioch or Polycarp. Okay, he was, burned at the stake. Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Justin Martyr, Tertullian. Okay, these are names that if you've been involved in any kind of formal study with church history, they pop out. Well, those people are the post-apostolic or the anti-Nicene fathers. So they have, and if you look at the chart, they have a connection to the apostles. So you take someone like John. Polycarp was a student of John. He was also a friend of Ignatius of Antioch, who was a student of Peter. And then Polycarp taught Irenaeus. Irenaeus taught Hippolytus. And then you have this idea that Justin Martyr, so there's this bloodline, this kind of connection taking place in the early church. So when we talk about the period immediately following the early church, you have this kind of period, okay? The post-apostolic and the anti-Nicene fathers. When you look at, it's right here. When you look at, I gave you this chart, this map, because I find this very, very interesting, because these are names, because of my studies, that I'm somewhat familiar with. Like John Chrysostom, he's called Golden Throat, because he was such a phenomenal orator. Athanasius is the one who, in his Easter letter, finalized the 27 books in the New Testament. Prior to him, and if you look at the slide below this, Athanasius, he's living at the beginning of the 4th century. And if you, this was the first time for the first 300 years, almost 400 years, that all 27 books of the New Testament were listed. Are you with me a little bit? Okay. So up until that time, you had listings, but they were not of the 27. So for the first time in a, it's called the Easter letter that Athanasius wrote to the church, his church, it listed all 27 books. So it isn't until the 4th century or in the middle of the 300s that we finally have the 27 books of the New Testament. So if you really think through this, the early church did not have at their disposal all 66 books that you and I now enjoy. But Athanasius is down here. Augustine is considered, he's claimed by both sides, the evangelical as well as the Roman church. Augustine of Hippo, and theologian, Latin Bible, Jerome, the Latin Vulgate. Okay? But all these guys, and what I find interesting is that all these guys are circling, because that's where Christianity was for the first 400 or 500 years, beyond that, around the Mediterranean Sea. And then I have for us on your notes, I have listed for us all the names and then the time period in which these people lived and their location. So you have the New Testament, first 100, 200, 300, give or take. you have the post-apostolic and the anti-Nicene fathers, the fathers preceding this period right here. Okay? The Nicene era, named after the Council of Nicaea in AD 325, is very possibly the most important era of Christian history. This is what I was taught as well. I've copied this from someone else as far as, you know, this is just gathered material. But that's how I was taught, that the Council of Nicaea in 325 was pivotal. And Constantine, when he, and I call it the politicizing of Christianity, when he mashed it all together, with the state, or made it fashionable to be a Christian, some would suggest that that was the beginning of the end, that the church before that time and then after that time was irrevocably altered. Though it encompasses only a short time period from perhaps AD 303, the start of the Great Persecution, to AD 383, the decree of Theodosius the First, the events of the Nicene era were earth-shaking, affecting not only Christianity but the history of the Western world. And again, I find this stuff fascinating. The Nicene era begins with the Great Persecution. It lasted until it was called off by Galerius in AD 311. Constantine the Great was converted, and you've perhaps heard this before, in a sense, by his famous vision as he prepared for battle his rival emperor in the West, and there was this obvious tension. While Constantine would not count himself a Christian until his baptism on his deathbed in AD 337, he did grant Christianity a favor and an influence in government that it had never before experienced. It would prove the end of Christianity as it was known before Nicaea. What I find interesting, because history doesn't happen in a vacuum. So in the first century, the first 100 years, you and I can pretty much, from the New Testament, describe what the church is like. But they all die. Now, how is that idea perpetuated? Right, through the disciples, through the students of the apostles. Those guys are the post-after apostles and the anti-before Nicaea or Nicene. That covers us, that gets us up to like the 300s. But what's the dominant empire during this time?
Rome.
Okay, Rome is the dominant element. It's now politicized and Christianity becomes fashionable. You can be a Christian. And that's happening in this whole 325 era.
Is this the time the Nicene Creed?
It's solidified. The Nicene Creed, all the creeds were probably spoken earlier, but like codified or, you know, edited and formalized around that time. Yeah. I'll point out all the ecumenical councils that are going on during this time. But when we talk about the spread of Christianity, and this map shows you by the time of Irenaeus to the time of Constantine, this is how Christianity is expanding. So in the first 300 to 400 years, this is what it looks like. And again, when did Islam rise? Okay, so the 7th century, the 600s. Okay, this is what Christianity looks like in the 300s. Then you have the rise of Muhammad, and for like 300 years, that thing's just big, broad brushstrokes. It's going to just invade. I'll show you that in just a minute. At the same time, I have here another map shortly, but at the same time, you have what are called the five patriarch cities, the five patriarchs of Rome, Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. In the early church, okay, Paul wrote a letter to Ephesus. To whom did he write that letter? Okay, to the church. Paul treated the church as a single unit, but that church gathered in different geographical locations. Are you with me so far? Okay. So you have Ephesus, and we'd say, well, that's the church, but that Paul addressed, but that church gathered in different geographical locations. As the church grows in each of these geographical locations, he had his disciples appoint elders. Okay? So you have elders, and there's a plurality of elders. Elders, plurality. And what would happen, which was just a normal thing, that communication between these groups would take place. And what would happen, that a elder here and an elder here would gather, and that these gathered elders, just because of function and structure, would appoint another elder. And that's happening in Ephesus. Then you have Colossae, and the same kind of thing would happen. Same kind of thing. Then these different cities would have this kind of a hierarchy. And you can say, well, I don't agree with that. It doesn't matter. This is just what happened. Why did it happen? Purely pragmatic. Purely pragmatic. How do you keep this thing together? How do you keep it moving forward so they create a structure? Well, eventually around the Mediterranean, I'm going to jump ahead and then I'll come back. I don't have to. It's right there. Around the Mediterranean, these cities became primary strongholds for this idea. So there was a primary elder or bishop in Rome, in Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. And when the church, and when I say the church, I mean this geographically defined assembly, when the church splits, it's going to split like this. And this part becomes what? Roman Catholicism, right? The Holy Roman Empire. And what's this going to become? Greek Orthodox. The Byzantine. And you do have two competing things. You have the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. Okay? So this is what it looks like in the first 300 to 400 years. You have these patriarchs. This is what you have, the rise. And by the way, what ends up happening? What happens to that elder? Yeah, he becomes the Pope. Yes? I would say so. Yeah, I can't answer that fully right now, but we have a lesson where we're going to look at Roman Catholicism as it developed and then the Greek Orthodox Church. Because there's a sense in which when you describe Roman Catholicism, you pretty much can describe Roman Catholicism. You know, but again, when you say, are you a Lutheran, I always ask, what question? Right. So I think it would be true with reference to the East. I think it's more splintered than this. What I find interesting and what I'm hoping is that as I offer you these pieces, lights will go off in your head. And you'll think, okay, I'm grabbing a bigger picture here. Okay? So you have the apostles, the post-apostolic, the Antonicene, now the Nicene. What happens in the 300s? Constantine, in a sense, christens Christianity. It's now fashionable. It now falls in a much more favorable light. Then you start having these ecumenical councils. We've heard of ecumenical councils. Okay? And in my background, coming out of militant fundamentalism, ecumenicalism is always looked upon or frowned upon in a very, very negative light. Okay? But this is not necessarily that. But you have this. And then with these seven ecumenical councils, there will be a debate between the West and the East as to what is actually a council. However, putting all that bickering aside, you have these seven. And why did they gather? Right, they're addressing problems. And I'm not going to go into what problems were being addressed at this time, but this is what's happening. And here's what I find interesting, because one of the questions that I would ask us is, what's going to happen right here? 476 AD to Rome. It falls. Okay, give or take a year. I mean, I think it's 476. But Rome's going to fall. And it didn't happen overnight. Okay? Didn't happen overnight. So while the Roman Empire is being assaulted by the barbarians coming out of Europe, you know, the above them, what's the church doing? Right. Okay. You have the empire being pressed on by the barbarians, and the church is having this internal dialogue. I would say that these things are necessary, but sometimes if the building's burning, what do you need to do? Get out of it. You need to do something. But this is what's happening during this period. Okay? What's happening here then? Islam. The rise of Islam. And what is the church doing? Fighting. Okay? Then you have the invasion of the Roman Empire. I'm not going to have you track the lines no more than I'm going to, but you just see that this thing's being just completely overwhelmed for 400 years. And what's interesting, when the invading army reached the outskirts of Rome, which had been left totally undefended in 410 Common Era, the Visigoths, led by Alaric, breached the walls of Rome and sacked the capital of the Roman Empire. So it wasn't just 476 that Rome falls. It was something that was happening over an extended period. In 476, Romulus, the last of the Roman emperors in the West, was overthrown by the Germanic leader, whatever the guy's name is, who became the first barbarian to rule in Rome. The order that the Roman Empire had brought to Western Europe for 1,000 years was no more. And I'm a simpleton. I'm not a master in church history. But for 1,000 years, Rome, in a sense, governed or ruled. Okay? So Rome comes to an end, and what begins? We can debate it. The Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages go from about 400, 500 AD to the 1500s. What's happening then in the 14, 1500s? Reformation or the Renaissance. The Renaissance, in a sense, fed it, because now you have, like, the Greek Testament. People are reading their scriptures again. Names like John Huss and John Wycliffe, okay? Those are the they call them the mourning doves. They're the precursors to the Reformation. Gutenberg, the printed page, right? All that stuff's happening right then. But what's, I always get ahead of myself because I think this stuff's so fascinating. But you have a element that is providing stability to the known world. And what is that element? Right. Roman what?
Roman army.
Okay, the Roman Empire. Jim?
The thing that I found fascinating in studying that was that during that time when the Huns were invading, the church was invading the Huns. So there was this thing going out and invading, and even though the Roman Empire would fall, Christianity would still
be moving out. I have a softness to the power that the Roman Church surrounded itself with, in that when the Roman Empire collapsed, the people were decentralized. They left the cities and they went to the country. Illiteracy, trade, all that stuff was collapsing. Well, something had to go into that vacuum. Something had to provide a sense, in my mind, a sense of stability to people. And what walked in? Well, the Roman Catholic Church. You know, so you have this buildup of power, just massive power. Yeah, Michael?
Would you say that that fostered compromise? Just kind of, because it seems to work that way?
Well, the problem with power is that it what?
Corrupts.
An absolute power. You know, they... So I don't doubt that it had that, you know. It's just the nature of the beast, you know. And sometimes we have a tendency, which we'll see, and I come from a Roman Catholic background, but we have a tendency, at least initially, to use broad brush strokes in painting all popes as incredibly evil people. But not all popes were evil. I'm not saying they were saved. I'm just saying that they weren't necessarily evil. Some were very, very bad, and it's simply because They were unregenerate, and they had absolute power. Yeah, Jim?
And I would say yes, because a few years later, now you have Islam invading and coming up to Spain, Charlemagne, and you have the Pope trying to solve all of this. So there was a huge compromise to be able to battle off Islam.
Yeah.
So there was just a lot.
Yeah. And that's really what I'm trying to bring out. I'm not going to be able to answer every question, but there's a lot of moving parts. And sometimes, and like I said, we have a tendency to take snapshots and thinking it happens in vacuums, but it's not happening in a vacuum at all. And you have these Ante-Nicene, Nicene, and the Post-Nicene fathers, and during that same period of time, Rome is collapsing as an empire. But as Jim says, you still have this missional aspect where the message is going out. But then you have this massive vacuum because Rome's done. So the church steps in, and it's just a powerful thing. So you have, and I think in blocks. So for Christianity is wedged somewhat in between, let's say zero, the Roman Empire. And there's like a ton of stuff that the Roman Empire brought that enabled the gospel to go out. But this 476, the empire collapses. It's now being ruled by a barbarian. And you walk into what are considered the Dark Ages for the West. Okay, it wasn't the Dark Ages for the entire world, just the West. But in that gap or vacuum, you have the Roman Catholic Church. You still have these five patriarchs. But in 622 through 750, this is the spread of Islam. Okay, Islam is spreading like wildfire. How is Islam spreading?
Militarily.
So what does the church do? Yeah, I mean it there's compromise. You know, the church starts wielding the sword and the axe. I always think that's a bad idea, by the way, for the church to establish military presence. I just think it's a bad idea. It never really ends well. But it's easy to look back and say, this is what I would have done. I'm not sure what I would have done, perhaps hide. But Islam is just spreading through this whole area. And then, in my mind, it's interesting study. Then, to add, as it were, injury to insult, the Eastern and Western Church splits. And it's always interesting when you look at these charts, depending on whether or not it's the Greek Orthodox or whether or not it's a Roman Catholic putting the chart together. Depends on how it will be emphasized. But the Great Schism, also called the East-West Schism, occurred in 1054 AD, resulted in a division between Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism. Theological, ideological. Yeah, and I come across stuff. That's when I get further on down the road. I'm giving you broad brush strokes right now, but as to what were they actually choking on, then we'll look at it. But what are we? What are we out of? You say, well, I'm not. But we actually are.
Evidently the Church of Rome.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, you can do a B.H. Carroll, the blood of the bloodline or trail of blood or whatever, and say, well, we were never part of that. I don't even know if that rings a bell with anyone here, but we are a product of the Western Church or Roman Catholicism. And I would argue that a tendency is to say, well, what Rome is today is what Rome was then, and that's not necessarily true. What Rome is today is after 2,000 years. What Rome was then was different, and it was a different context. I'm not saying that Rome was evangelical, I'm just saying it was different. And then the Christians in Western Europe became the Roman Catholic Church, and Christians in Eastern Europe became the Eastern Orthodox Church. And by the way, there are significant differences between Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church. And this chart would identify both groups as what? Christian, okay, which is always interesting. Because there are significant theological differences between these two groups. But this split happened in 1054. And the four patriarchs, Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, and it's going way over here, Antioch, Constantinople in Turkey, Antioch is in Syria, Turkey, the border, Jerusalem and Israel, and then Alexandria and Egypt. Those four are part of that, and then Rome is that thing over there. I know we're dealing with, you know, these broad brush strokes, but then we have the Crusades. But think of our time frames. Okay? And it's you have the apostles. You have the post-apostolic Antonicene fathers, people that we would perhaps know, Polycarp, Tertullian, Justin Martyr. Then you have the Nicene, 325, Council of Nicaea. You have Constantine, in a sense, the politicizing of Christianity, and I know that that might be an overstatement, but it helps us give a reference point. 300s, the 400 Roman Empire collapses. Okay? Well, what walks in the vacuum of that collapse is the church. The church starts taking on a role that it was not designed potentially to have. So now you have the church, and that church goes on for a long time, but you have the rise of Islam during all this. You have a pushback, and this is 1095 when the First Crusade starts. When did the East and West split? Yeah, their timing is impeccable. I'm being sarcastic. They divide, and then they have these crusades. It's like, yeesh, what a mess. Very little has changed, by the way. But what a mess. So you have the crusades. And the crusades go on from 1095 to 1289. This is a great slide, though. It sort of puts stuff in context. In general, the Middle Ages are defined by a lack of central government. And why? Rome falls. Okay. Decline of trade, population shift to rural areas, decrease in learning, and a rise in the power of the Roman Catholic Church. But what role did the church, forget the Roman for a moment, what role, and Catholic simply means universal, it's the church that existed around the Mediterranean, what role did the church take on?
Government,
trade, they're ministering to a shifted population, they're having schools of learning, and, you know, they're just walking in and doing what needs to be done. I find this interesting. That's why I give it to you. But in 476, the Roman Empire fell in Western Europe. Without a centralized government, people fled from the cities to the country. Historians refer to the years between 476 and the Renaissance, which will be the Reformation, there's a sense in which the Renaissance is the precursor because learning explodes and people take, again, an interest. What is the Greek translation of the King James Bible? Erasmus. Erasmus is a product child or leader within the Renaissance. And he's the one who pushes the Greek New Testament, and that's what explodes learning. At least inside the church, people like Martin Luther. But you have historians refer to the years as the Middle Ages. However, at the same time, because we'll say, well, those are the Dark Ages, at the same time that the Western Europe was in the Middle Ages, the eastern half of the Roman Empire continued as the Byzantine Empire, and the Islamic world was experiencing a golden age. Which, again, that stuff, I just find it so, you know, Dark Ages, well, for whom? So here we have this 1,000-year period. So Rome was here for 1,000 years. It falls. You have Europe in the Middle Ages, and then right here, the church, secular culture awakens, and then you have the church awakening as well. Let's break.